It's the pre-infected edition of Radio Free Thinker. With Locke this week, journal jailbreak, pre-infected PCs, drug strategy, and interview with a wise man. Let's begin episode 125.
They call you Lady Luck, but there is room for doubt. At times you have a very unladylike way of running out. You're on this date with me. The pickings have been lush. And yet before this evening is over, you might give me the brush. You might forget your manners. You might refuse.
Hello and welcome to Radio Free Thinker, the radio show podcast that promotes skepticism and critical thinking right here on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver. My name is Ethan, your free thinking historian.
And this is Dawn, your political science philosopher.
Jenna, your favorite biochemist, I'm sure.
So guys, this week we can chalk up a little bit of a win. Apparently, Texas is trying to keep creationism out of the science class.
No, why?
The Texas Board of Education voted to reject any inclusion of material submitted by a New Mexico company, International Database, which claims that Darwin's theory of evolution is not proven and that life on Earth was a result of intelligent design. Conservatives have complained that the material that was approved isn't adequate because it does not address alternatives to evolution such as creationism and intelligent design. The board had not actually voted on science educational material since 2009, where a pro-creationist board lowered standards and promoted the quote-unquote discuss the debate position. For those who don't remember, the discuss the debate position is an attempt of creationists to get the quote-unquote scientific intelligent design theory to be discussed and debated as an alternative to evolution. So it looks like there's a bit of a pushback on the Texas Board of Education, which we've been bitching about for who knows, months, years.
I'm going to say in Texas, no less. Manitoba, catch up.
Yes, yes.
The important aspect of this as well is because Texas is such a big state and many textbook manufacturers will just make all of their textbooks to Texas's standards simply because they save more money than reprinting 10, 20 different versions for each different state.
Of course, the downside to this, is because of current budget issues, it's only supplementary material that's being considered, and an entirely new textbook is sort of out of the budget bounds at the moment. So a partial victory, maybe.
Sure.
Well, it actually reminds me, it's quite similar to a report I was reading on for the BBC science reporting that came out last week. And the investigator there also determined that, yes, there's arguably more than one side to every debate, but that doesn't mean that work on the fringe of science should be given more credit than it deserves. So this report basically found that in the interest of representing both sides of debates like evolution and alternative medicine, etc., too much credibility was being given to pseudoscience, and that should be stopped, and science should sort of really core, effective science should be stated for what it is, and the same thing for pseudoscience.
Well, and another issue that complicates this, or actually, I don't know, maybe it takes away from the BBC article, is, I mean, the intelligent design creationist sort of thing isn't even a scientific, it's not even on the fringes of science, it's not even science. Because you are right, I mean, especially in the alternative medicine area, you do get things that are debatable, but possible or plausible, perhaps, to a certain degree. And again, saying that each one has equal weight is often where news articles tend to go wrong.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's been the latest strategy with the intelligent design lobby, is to paint this as an alternative, that it's your academic freedom to learn about the other theories that are out there. I mean, if they were teaching, you know, Lamarckian evolution, that's okay, that's a legitimate alternative. It's wrong, but it's an alternative. This is just religion disguised as science.
Ethan, what is Lamarckian evolution?
I'm not going to tell you, Don.
Oh, you don't know, do you?
No, I don't.
The Lamarckian evolution, if I remember correctly, is parents pass on traits that they learn to their children. So a giraffe's children are taller because the parent stretched its neck out to try and reach the fruit, and in stretching, it passed on that learned trait to its children.
Yeah.
Which is, interestingly enough, right now having not a resurgence in the initial way that it was meant, but epigenetic studies are starting to really give some sort of credit to this kind of idea, in that people's grandchildren are starting to sort of see the result of their grandparents' PTSD in some of their physical traits.
Epigenetic? I'm sorry. I know all of our listeners have their PhD in biology, biochemistry, and the sciences. But when you say epigenetic, what do you mean? And this particular effect, which I've read quite a bit about, is
genetic. The genes that you have, the actual coding sequences that encode for proteins that make you who you are. Epigenetic, the markers that are basically how these genes are organized, accessed, and how they are accessible to your body to be able to be used.
Turned on and turned off, sort of thing.
Exactly.
So you're saying that if my grandparents, for example, were brought up in a period of famine, their genetic structure doesn't change, but when their children will have some characteristics that will turn on different genes in their genetic code.
Might have. It was previously thought to be not heritable, in the traits of your parents would not be passed on to you, but research in the last little while has been showing that this is a whole new level to genetic influence that we didn't even know about.
Could be an interesting segment. Anyone interested in that should let us know at info@radiofreethinker.com.
In the meantime, Jenna, what's this I hear about trouble for the co-founder of Reddit?
Well, Mr. Aaron Schwartz, a 24-year-old programmer and online activist, is getting himself in trouble. He was indicted last Tuesday, in Boston on charges that he stole over 4 million documents, I think it was 4.8 or so, documents from the Massachusetts Institute of Technology and JSTOR, which stands for Journal Storage. It's basically an archive of scientific journals and academic papers. So the charges could result in up to 35 years in prison and a $1 million fine. In a press release, it was reported that Mr. Schwartz broke into a restricted area of MIT and entered a computer wiring closet. So Mr. Schwartz apparently then accessed the MIT computer network and stole millions of documents from JSTOR. So this was sort of from the original press release. However, there's a few details that this release didn't let on very well. Firstly, Mr. Schwartz himself had legal access to all of these documents. He was a student who the institution pays JSTOR to be able to access the documents, and he himself had legal access to any one of these documents he would have liked.
He was a fellow of MIT doing research into, I believe, social justice. And as a fellow, MIT had allowed him to use the license that MIT had paid JSTOR for. And technically, he was stealing the articles from JSTOR, not from MIT.
Exactly. So he had not actually distributed any of these documents to anybody other than himself at the time that he was arrested.
Which I thought was really interesting, because when I was doing some research into this, I was, first of all, had to point out that of the 4.1 million articles that he had downloaded, only about 1.6 of them, 1.8 of them, were ones that were for sale. The rest were just, you could have got for free anyhow. And actually, some of his defenders have been pointing out that, in an odd way, what he was being charged with was overusing his library card, that he was downloading all these articles, but there was nothing innately wrong with downloading these articles. That being said, he did violate the access agreement that he had signed on to with MIT, because it does say that you can't use a robot, like a computer program, to download these articles, and that when he was cut off from access from his regular computer, he had got another computer and sort of faked an ID to get on, and then eventually he ended up hardwiring himself onto the network, which is where the wiring closet comes into it. That, again, it wasn't so much illegal access, but he was plugged into a place where he wasn't really supposed to, but he was still doing something that, in an odd sort of way, was still part of the agreement.
And just to be clear, the reason that he had to plug into the wiring closet in the first place was that he was downloading so much and putting such a strain on the server, and MIT was trying to stop him, that day they cut off all access to all JSTOR papers for all students and faculty to try and stop him from doing that. But the intrepid Mr. Schwartz foiled their plan and got into the closet to plug in.
One of the things I thought was disturbing about this particular article, one thing to understand a bit more about Schwartz is that, one, he's very much into progressive politics. So he's very much, he's part of watchdog.org and another group, which I can't remember now off the top of my head, which is intent to sort of show how corrupting money is in institutions and politics, and he's trying very hard to push against that. He's also a prominent member in Open Library, which is, again, an attempt to say that knowledge should be free and everyone should have access to it, and there should be no financial gatekeeper to that. So, I mean, he was trying to do this for a particular reason, but he's being charged with the sale or the possible distribution of this articles, but he hasn't actually done it. I mean, in the original write-up, they say that he's being charged that he was going to distribute them through peer-to-peer networking. But, I mean, again, isn't that sort of like thought crime or pre-crime? Because, I mean, he hadn't actually done it yet. I mean, he did violate the licensing agreement by downloading it. And that strikes me as sort of a contractual, a civil court sort of issue that he violated, not a criminal court one. And that until he actually redistributed the product, he hadn't actually committed a federal crime.
And just in case we sort of glossed over it at the beginning of this discussion, what he was actually stealing, for those who might not be familiar with the jargon we're using, is academic papers. So these are those incredibly jargon-filled, dense, very specific research articles that we sometimes talk about, and it's millions of those that he's stealing. And furthermore, this material, or the hard drive that it was on, was actually returned to JSTOR. And the folks there say that that was their objective, to get the material back, to get it out of the hands of the intrepid Mr. Schwartz, and saying that they really didn't want to see any further court proceedings on the subject, which is seeming to go ahead nonetheless.
Which again leads to some people who are saying this is an attempt to persecute him, not for his academic misconduct, we'll assume it was academic misconduct to break the rules.
Or specifically, wire fraud, computer fraud, unlawfully obtaining information from a protected computer, and recklessly damaging a protected computer.
I love the protected computer thing. I was looking up the actual the criminal law that covers that, and it was like someone had added an amendment, because the original, there are three clauses that are protected. One is at American nuclear power plants. If you access a computer or a nuclear power plant, or if you access
protected.
Yeah, a Department of Defense computer. And then the C is a protected computer, which is like, well, the first two you can say, okay, those are, but what qualifies as a protected computer?
And monkey with a bat.
Yep.
Well, let's take a commercial break here on Radio Free Thinker, and we'll be back with more after this.
Then there's the utter misery that is college radio, where they apparently just let any bewildered freshman wander into the booth and try to run a radio station. Campus Outreach is looking for... Hang on. College radio can pretty much be summed up in five words.
CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver.
Become a friend of CITR and receive great discounts at businesses around Vancouver.
Your Friends of CITR card will get you discounts on Main Street at Antisocial Skateboard Shop, Devil May Wear,
Woo Vintage,
The Kiss Store, Lucky's Comics, Neptune Records, Red Cat Records, The Regional Assembly of Text, RX Comics, Temple of the Modern Girl,
Flaming Angels Boutique,
and The Wallflower Modern Diner.
Pays
to be a friend of CITR. To find out more, come visit us in room 233 of the sub on UBC campus or visit us online at citr.ca.
We're back on Radio Freethinker. So, Don, tell us about pre-infected PCs.
Wow. If you weren't afraid before, be afraid now. In a recent hearing by the House Oversight and Government Reform Committee, Greg Schaefer, Acting Deputy Undersecretary of the Department of Homeland Security, National Protection and Programs Directorate, boy, I'd like to see his business card, stated that there were instances where consumer electronics were imported with hardware or software security risks. These risks were implied to be purposeful and with the intent of surveillance, spying, and or as a potential weapon, such as a kill switch on electronics. There's been a lot of concern mentioned lately about the security of the supply chain, that's the word, supply chain, as computers, portable devices, and other electronics pass through several suppliers before finally going on sale in the U.S., which is a point of interest for this particular article, although it'd be just as pertinent here. A federal report released in January on the supply chain between the United States and China speculated that the possibility that somewhere along the line someone could compromise a component or design, a capability that could be enabled as a cyber attack, were high. Of course, it's always difficult to identify real intent versus accidents. During the design phase of software, including that's embedded into hardware, most of the little electronic devices you have, like your TV and all that, has actual software in it, even though you don't think of it as software. When you design that, it's quite common practice to include things like backdoors or quick switches or tracking logs to facilitate debugging. This code gets left in due to forgetfulness. Anyone who's ever played a video game will know there are all sorts of quote-unquote hacks that can be used to alter the gameplay, to advance you in levels, to give you superpowers, which were originally put in there, again, not for your purpose, but for the game designers to just make it easier for them to design the game. Almost all were created not for the benefit of the player, as they say, but for the programmer. Occasionally, infections happen accidentally. At a recent conference, IBM was embarrassed to discover that on USB memory sticks that they were handing out was malware. They were accidentally spreading viruses with their little promotional, here's a USB memory stick, here's a USB memory stick. Did you get a USB memory stick from Tam?
Not this year.
Oh, don't plug it in.
This can also be a real huge issue recently because there are actually interesting instances where cyber attacks are occurring. In recent news, Stuxnet, which is a virus that was believed to be created by Israel, the United States, or both, which was released onto the internet with a very specific purpose of making the motors on centrifuges go out of control and essentially blow themselves up. And this was actually a very form of what's considered to be the first real cyber attack in history. Now, this becomes really important in the sense that recently, the U.S. Pentagon added cyber attacks as a legitimate causes belli or justification for war. This means that if there is a major malfunction of some key hardware or software in the United States, and the Americans believe that this was actually done intentionally, they may go to war with someone like, I don't know, China or whatever. So, I don't know, this whole idea of pre-infected computers is an interesting thing. I think there's going to be more talk about it. But on the one hand, you have the whole idea that these computers, because of the global structure, can never really be secure in any meaningful sense, that as we start exploring the cyber sphere as another area to exhibit political and military influence, that it may actually become, you know, war games sort of idea.
You know, I'm thinking about sort of how, like, an iPad or something goes through so many different hands before it gets to, you know, the future shop that we buy it from. I mean, is that, are they saying that it's going to happen, or that it's happening now, that malicious software is getting put on them, or is it only probable that it could happen?
So up until now, it's always been a theoretical risk. Mm-hmm. But one of the bombshells sort of this Greg Schaefer's comments is that they have actually identified instances where they believe this actually has happened. Now, again, they didn't give out too many details, because oddly enough, if they give up too much details, that sort of gives away how they can detect this sort of thing and make it easier for those who are trying to do it to cover their tracks the next time. Mm-hmm. So it does appear to be something that is being done. And it doesn't even have to be sort of the cyber attack. One of the big things that everyone's pointing to China towards isn't that China would be someone who would put out software or malware in order to attack the United States, but just for common espionage. If anyone has heard or not heard about the phone hacking scandal in England, which is spreading to the United States, I mean, there's a lot of malicious things done with new electronics that has nothing to do with attacks. It's just plain old greed.
Well, I mean, if some enterprising worker in some factory found out that they could put a program on that remembers credit card numbers, that's a pretty useful way to steal information.
Well, absolutely. And not just as the internet starts to become important in government, but just in our daily lives, as its ubiquity really increases, it only makes sense to use that as a tool for malicious purposes. So in that way, this sort of concept of a more organized attempt at using this to go against countries and whatnot, I find a little scary on two sides. One, that first off, that could happen, but more so, again, in the way that a country might choose to deal with that. And it reminds me a lot about the former president's speech after September 11th, when he said that we will make no distinction between the terrorists who committed these acts and those who harbor them, and the potential for starting really major conflicts over things that might be a little more compartmentalized.
Well, and like I say, the there were two parts to this sort of our segment here. Is one, the idea that the internet and computer electronics is being used as a means of potential attack or malfeasance. But the other one is that, at least in the United States now, it says that this will qualify as an act of war. And then you have to sit back and you say, well, in the old days, like if I had a gun and I went and I shot somebody, right, it was me and I could kill two people, and the Canadian government could say, well, he was a lone wolf or some nut job, right? But as you mentioned, if your factory worker in whatever factory in the world puts in a little malicious software into something that's multiplied billions of times, shipped all over the country, and he flips a switch, it's going to be a lot harder for the United States to either, one, distinguish the lone wolf from the nation, but its response may be the same either way. And suddenly the risk factor has just multiplied along with the opportunity and availability of this technology to spread chaos throughout the world. I think we should just shut down the internet.
Yeah, or just start watching more Ghosts in the Shell.
Oh, yes.
Yeah. But speaking of drug strategies,
yes,
Jenna.
I think I fell asleep there for a second. Well, so where do drugs come from, Ethan?
I get them from Bob. He hangs out by the 7-Eleven.
Well, where our drugs come from, of course, most of our drugs, is from scientific research. And something that I thought would be interesting to talk about briefly here is exactly the kind of strategies that we use to get them and how effective they are. So there are basically a couple of main approaches you can take when doing drug discovery research, and that's either a target-based approach or phenotypic screening.
Target-based approach? What do you mean?
Well, you identify a target. So this can be either the component of a human cell, or for antibiotic research and whatnot, it can be a component of a bacterial cell. And then you try and come up with in a rational fashion, a compound that can affect that target.
Come on, Don. That was an easy one.
Yeah, okay.
Come on. Keep up. The second approach, phenotypic screening, is much more of a shotgun approach. So you take a certain process that you're looking at, and then you throw a bunch of compounds at it. So this can either be from an established library of compounds or a bunch of natural products from a natural source. And then you basically see what sticks.
So to distinguish the two, I'm sitting there, I'm trying to dry my meat by making beef jerky.
Okay.
I know, it was the first thing that came to my head. So one, I could sit there and say, well, I know one compound that's good for dry meat is salt. So I could try salt on it. Versus the other style of approach would be, I want to make beef jerky, so I'm going to take all the spices in my spice rack and throw it on the meat and see which one actually does any work.
Kind of.
Okay.
Except instead of knowing that salt dries meat, you might know the effect salt has on water and rationally think this might dry the meat, and so give that a shot. So basically, with the target-based approach, you know the physiological mechanism you're going to have an effect on, but you don't know the effect on the whole organism, whereas with the screening, you know the effect on the whole organism, but you might have to go looking for the mechanism, and both make sense on paper. However, a group of scientists just wrote a paper, wrote a sort of a perspective piece for Nature Reviews, where they went back over the literature and examined the new drugs that have been brought to market over the last 10 years. And they found that for new classes of small molecule drugs, almost twice as many were derived from screening approaches than from target-based approaches. So this in and of itself isn't too interesting, except for when you think of this is in a time when drug development has absolutely been dominated by target-based research, yet that approach is yielding fewer results than the phenotypic screening. So this brings up a lot of issues for me because they hint at the sometimes conflicting motivations in scientific research. So I think we can all pretty much agree that the public wants science it can use, and in this case, functional drugs. And the public funding agencies tend to want the same things as the public because that's what keeps the money coming in and not diverted exclusively to building tanks. So some scientists want functional drugs because they can, or because it's good for society, or they like developing stuff, etc. However, there are a lot of scientists who are basically just curious human beings and want to study cool stuff. So in an immediate sense, the target-based research is better for this last type of motivation because it involves directly studying the target, not only in the context of possible drugs, but in all kinds of other ways as well. So this method allows for intentional investigation of the natural world in a broader context than just drugs discovery. Screening, on the other hand, does sometimes lead to science, sort of basic science discoveries, but it's sort of in a much slower, much more drug-centric matter. No matter what way you slice it, the target-based approach, you're investigating things in a more direct way, which can be really sort of motivational to scientists. So this paper points out what many scientists want to do isn't actually in line with the producing the outcomes that the greater public might want to see. And in my personal opinion, it exposes the not so dirty, dirty little secret of medical research science, that it's not all about improving health or improving environmental issues, etc., but also about knowing sort of general exploration of life science. So as a research scientist who truly values gathering knowledge in any field, I hope the secret doesn't get out too widely, as I'm frankly dubious about how happy the public would be to fund basic research without an immediate societal benefit, especially if they could see the price tag.
So, Jenna, not to put you on the spot here.
Okay.
Lights on. Can you give an example of the two types of approaches in a more specific sort of sense? I tried to use my making beef jerky, which was a horrible, horrible analogy, but
really,
maybe...
Really, really awful.
It wasn't a good analogy.
No, I'm not the biochemist in the room.
Okay, so for example, myself, I study enzymes in tuberculosis, and on everything that I write, we're talking about looking for new drug strategies, targeting a process which we think is important to the bacteria to survive in humans. So then we target down, and I look at a specific enzyme that's involved in that process and then try and inhibit that enzyme so it can't do its job, so the process can't happen, and ostensibly then the bug wouldn't be able to survive. Target-based.
Okay.
Screening, you take a bug, you shove it in a mouse or a macrophage or a cell type, whatever, under a growth condition that you think is pertinent to infection, and then you stick a whole bunch of compounds in there, you purify them out and stick them in individually, and you figure out what makes it stop growing, and then you figure out why.
Okay. So, you're starting with, we know we can stop it growing by preventing this, we just need to find some way to prevent this. The other one is, we don't know what will work, but we'll try all these chemicals until something stops and figure out why did it stop it.
And the very pertinent thing for drug discovery is that when you're going from a target-based approach, once you figure out, you first have to figure out a target and what might be important, and then you have to actually develop a compound. Whereas when you start from the screening approach, you have a lead compound to start with right off the bat. You have something you know works. You just have to develop it into a drug, which is one of the reasons why this process, although you do have to figure out how it worked for the drug to get approved, that kind of approach does lead to faster drug discovery.
Excellent. Well, thanks, Jenna, for that. We're going to go to a commercial break here on Radio Free Thinker, but when we come back, we'll have our first of our TAM interviews, and coming up is Richard Wiseman, so stay tuned for hearing more from the Wiseman about science, luck, and skepticism. Stay tuned, folks.
Why did you eat the whole thing?
Hi!
You snuck in my room and got him and shut the door, because I told you not to eat anymore. Why'd you eat so many?
I love M&M's.
I know you love M&M's, but now you're going to have a tummy ache.
No, I'm not.
Yeah, you are.
When I have a rumbly in my tummy, the only thing that makes me feel better is listening to CITR 101.9 FM.
Yeah, the state of hip-hop right now, man, as far as the way I see it, I think right now, hip-hop is advancing as far as skills. You got brothers, you know what I'm saying, getting, like, more witty.
There ain't nobody to be pretty for. Let it rattle, let the clatter kill him, let the cataclysm wash. Who really listens? Precision with a verse draws a crowd. Draw a line between an easy melody and peace of mind.
You got DJs doing all kind of crazy shit on the turntables. I like where it's going, and I like, you know what I'm saying, the creative process that brothers is trying to take it to right now.
Rally Rails and Brendan Butter in the place to be. Crimes and Treasons Radio, 101.9 FM, Vancouver, CITR.ca, every Tuesday, 9 till 11.
Dynamite!
Joining us now on Radio Free Thinker is Richard Wiseman, author of such books as 59 Seconds, Quirkology, and the newly published Paranormality. Welcome to the show, Richard.
A pleasure to be here.
So you look into and investigate unusual areas of psychology. What draws you to topics like luck and lying and self-help?
I guess if there's one word that would bring it all together, for me it would be relevant. It's material and topics which are relevant for people's lives. I think as an academic, it's very easy to do your research, you publish it in journals, and then it's locked away in those journals, and whatever it is, an average of 2.3 people read your papers, and that's it. And with my work, I wanted to get it out there. And also to do work that when the public heard about it, they'd go, well, that's kind of interesting. You know, there's a guy looking at luck or taking a look at self-help or the paranormal or whatever it is. Topics which seem relevant to their lives.
And let's talk about luck for a minute. What factors make someone lucky? Isn't it just random chance?
Well, the Luck Project started about 15 years ago, and then the thinking was either it was random chance, it was like winning or losing the lottery, there was no science to be done, or it was kind of weird superstitious thinking. These people weren't really lucky, you know, they're just kidding themselves. So we tracked the lives of about 1,000 exceptionally lucky and unlucky people, and we could see that with the exception of some sorts of major accidents and illnesses, for the most part, they're creating their own luck by the way they were thinking and behaving. So just to give an example of that, the lucky people were very resilient, and since we've been conducting the research, we've seen that resilience is a key psychological skill, that when bad things happen to them, they had all sorts of strategies in place to bounce back. The unlucky people, as soon as the smallest negative life event came their way, they got dragged down.
Mm-hmm.
And so these sorts of psychologies, it gets into optimism, it gets into intuition, it gets into making the most of opportunities, allow us to sort of unpack the psychology of luck and allows for the potential, once you understand how lucky people think and behave, of actually increasing your luck, as it were.
So we're in Las Vegas. What advice can you give to someone who wants to be lucky in Las Vegas?
Keep away from the casino, I think, would be my best advice. When you're in a casino, for the most part, you're against chance, you know, a roulette wheel or if you're playing poker or whatever. Now, that's not the type of system you want to be against. It doesn't matter how optimistic or pessimistic you are, you're not going to be influencing the role of that ball. When it comes to life, meeting the right people, being in the right place at the right time, making the most of opportunities, it may feel like chance, it may feel like you're at the casino, but it's not. There's all sorts of psychology at work. So I don't think any of our lucky people would be in that casino expecting to do well. Interestingly enough, some of our unlucky people may be out there, because that's their kind of plan for moving ahead, is just to sort of get lucky in the lottery or whatever.
Right.
And of course that's not a particularly useful way of looking at the world.
And perhaps people who do win know when to quit when they're ahead, as opposed to sort of riding it out.
Absolutely, and the best advice I ever heard is you know, never put down any money that you can't afford to lose. You know, it's entertainment, so if you can afford to lose the money, that's great. But obviously with some unlucky people, things are not going well, and they think, well, this is going to be a sort of magical cure. I'll go there and I'll make some money and everything will be fine. And of course, what you could be doing is just sort of digging yourself in deeper.
What about books like The Secret that claim that you can improve your life by just thinking positively? Does your research kind of say that's possible?
I've got very mixed thoughts about The Secret. At one level, I think being optimistic about the future, for the most part, is a good thing. It becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy. People work harder. They persist in the face of failure and so on. But then this notion of the mechanism is the universe magically providing for you runs against everything I believe in as an atheist and as a skeptic. So I think they've got the mechanism wrong, but some of the advice, some of it, I think is psychologically sound.
Right.
And it's exactly the same with neuro-linguistic programming, you know, which people go into businesses and train on NLP. Some of it is fine, and a lot of it isn't. Mm-hmm. And so I think the important thing is people do understand the psychology so they can separate one from the other.
Okay. And in terms of self-help, your book, 59 Seconds, is all about the scientifically established ways to improve your life. What are some of the unscientific ways that you encountered when researching your book?
Well, there's all sorts of bad science out there with self-help. And in fact, it was driven by me hearing about the Harvard Motivational Study, which is this study where a group of researchers go into some school. They ask kids, do you know what you want to be when you grow up? The 3% that knew, when they track that group 15 years later, account for 90% of the income of the cohort. Mm-hmm. So it argues for focusing early. One small problem with that study, it doesn't exist. It's never been run. It's a complete myth. Even though if you search for it on Google Books, you will see it in literally thousands of books. So I was being skeptical about that. I was saying, look, this is crazy. People are basing important life decisions on this work, and there's no one going, oh, and it's not even that it's not true. It never even existed in the first place. So 59 Seconds looks at all the different areas of self-help, whether it's you know, happiness or persuasion or motivation, and says, look, this is the stuff that works. This is the stuff which is essentially mythical.
Mm-hmm. So where did this mythical study come from then?
That's a very good question. I don't think we know. I think at some point, some motivational trainer stood up and said it, and that mm-hmm. was that. What's interesting about it is it's not even close to anything which is out there. Normally in psychology, somebody conducts a study, and it gets twisted and twisted and twisted, and 10 years later it's being cited in a sort of bizarre way. But you can trace back the original one. What's right. interesting about this is we can't find that. So it is quite bizarre. It's like the 90% myth, the idea that you only use 10% of your brain. That one can be traced back. And to be fair, the first person who said it wasn't saying that. What they were saying was you are only 10% of your sort of abilities, that you can maximize your potential. And right. the word brain got in there somewhere along the road and made a mockery of it. So, no, it's all very curious.
And sort of on that vein, did you come across people out there who you didn't think had the best of intentions when it came to self-help, that they're more interested in just selling a book than actually helping people?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, the self-help industry is about helping itself, not mm-hmm. helping you. If you go into someone's home and look on their books shelf, if you see one self-help book, you'll see a whole load. I mean, they're like pack animals. They kind of hunt in packs. And that's the first clue that any one of them doesn't work.
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely. And in fact, it's a bit like inventing the light bulb that works forever. You haven't got much of a business plan. So in a sense, what you want is a self-help book that makes people feel good for a month or so, and then they lapse back, and then they come and buy the next one. I think there is a vested interest in that.
So I guess something to look for if you're looking for a self-help book is one that only has one book by an author and not a series.
Well, that's part of it. And also, to be honest, I mean, ask your friends, you know, if they've had similar problems that you've had, just go and say to them what seemed to work.
Mm-hmm.
It's that straightforward. But don't be pulled in by the marketing because I would always go with first-hand experience rather than reading, you know, 10 people saying that this is wonderful.
And your new book, Paranormality, has trouble finding a U.S. publisher. What's your thoughts on that?
It was terribly depressing. I wrote Paranormalities about the psychology of the paranormal, why people see ghosts and believe in psychics and so on. And we sold it all over the world, along with all the other books, I think it's in 20 languages now. And then it came to America, where obviously you'd expect there to be a big market because there's such high belief in the paranormal, higher than most places. And no publisher would touch it. Everyone said there's no audience for skepticism. And some said, if you just sort of tweaked it. So he said maybe ghosts are real or some psychics have magical abilities. But that tweak is a considerable rewrite. Then maybe there'd be an audience, and I wasn't prepared to do that. So I put it out myself, technology being what it is these days. It's got out as a self-published Kindle. And then the UK publisher are shipping in their copies to the US. So yeah, we're trying to make a little bit of a stand with it. But no, it was terribly depressing. But the good news is, with technology, you can do things, you know, like this self-publishing that even 5 years ago was a complete impossibility.
And for our Canadian listeners, what's the story for us? Will we be getting the book?
That's a very good question. Canada is covered under Macmillan UK, so yes, you will be getting it.
Excellent.
Yes.
Yeah, excellent. Right. And I was flipping through your book, and it's got a unique feature. It has these tags that you can scan with your smartphone. Where did this idea come from?
I can't remember where the idea came from, but basically they look like mosaic squares, and when you put a smartphone next to them, it allows you to link to a web page. And as soon as I saw them, I thought, hold on a second, we've got all this archive research footage of, you know, me testing a psychic dog or going to a psychic or whatever. We can bring this out, we can put it online, and then people can read about it and then suddenly see the footage. So as an author, it just seems a great thing to do. And in the same way as there are people I mention in the book, and there might be a couple of pages on, say, Sue Blackmore and out-of-body experiences, but then you can click on one of those links and it takes you to a 20-minute interview with Sue. So it's just exciting time to be producing books.
Excellent. And what are your thoughts on the popularity of the paranormal? Does it seem that popularity is kind of given a boost when shows like The X-Files or Ghost Hunters come out?
I think there is a strong correlation between what's on the popular media and what's in people's heads. And even The X-Files, which is clearly fiction, I still think influences people's beliefs about it. And because it's one of the reasons why I think there's a reluctance to publish Paranormality, that the psychic industry is like the self-help one. It's a very big industry, particularly when you think about psychic hotlines. You know, that's big money coming in. So there are groups of people out there that don't want you to hear the other side of the story. And the most contentious part of the book in the UK has been the chapter on how to go to a psychic, all the tricks of the trade to look for. The psychics have been very, very upset about that because that's suddenly a lot of their knowledge and power being taken away because now the tricks of the trade are out there. So I think there's groups of people that don't want this stuff out there.
When we talk about the popularity of the supernatural, they're able to get TV shows and do specials. What are they doing that the skeptics aren't doing, that we don't get TV shows?
Well, the notion that this stuff is true, the notion that ghosts exist or that you survive bodily death, I think those notions are simply more attractive than ghosts don't exist and when you're dead, that's it. I think they have an emotional hold over people. So I think the only way in for science, for skepticism, and it's the way I've taken the book, is to go, okay, what do these weird experiences tell us about our brains, our behavior, and our beliefs? And I think that's interesting. But it's only interesting to a relatively small number of people. You're never going to get the mass appeal that you get with The X-Files, for example.
Right.
So I think, you know, we tell folks our message, and we will always be playing to a thinner slice, I think.
Are you one of the investigators out there who kind of hopes that one day you will find a real ghost because it would be just so cool?
I don't think I ever believed. You know, there's some people that say that as kids they believed and they became skeptical because I've got a background in magic. I just don't think I did. I can't imagine what a ghost would be like. It doesn't make any sense to me at all. I'm far more likely to believe in something like ESP, where I could sort of see a mechanism, maybe, kind of, possibly. Mm-hmm. I don't find that way out there. Ghosts, I just think, look, this is just silly. You know, the notion that when you're dead, somehow you walk through a wall and haunt people, I just can't see that. So I can't get my head around that one.
And you've investigated paranormal claims. What's your favorite claim that you've investigated?
There are so many. I mean, all the investigations I'm very fond of for different reasons. I suppose the time we spent at Hampton Court Palace, which is a royal palace just south of London, and it is a royal palace, I mean, it's where royalty go and stay, and we were the only team that's ever been allowed into the palace. We got to spend 10 days there. And that was joyous because you got such special access to this amazing place. It houses the Queen's painting collection, art collection. And so just be walking around there at night with every picture you look at worth, you know, millions of pounds. It was quite exciting. So that was great. And the proper history of that place, you know, being in a room at night on your own and thinking, this is the room where history was properly made. I mean, you know, what happened in this room changed the course of British history. That's exciting. That's far more exciting to me than any ghost. You know, there is a kind of ghost in the room, if you like, but it's history. It's not somebody walking through the wall. So I genuinely got a sort of shiver up my spine to think, you know, this is where kings and queens of England have decided the way forward. This is where people have been killed just because of their political beliefs in the past. I found that exciting.
Hmm. And are you able to tell what percentage of the claims that you investigate are hoaxes and which are true believers?
Most of them are true believers. There's been one or two when I was in India testing gurus where you think, no, that's sleight of hand. You know it's sleight of hand. You're faking it. Most of the time, the people that come to us are perfectly sincere in their beliefs. They've had a strange experience, and they themselves believe it. And that raises then interesting ethical issues.
What do you think of the term true believers? Are they really truly believing, or do they believe because they really want what they think happened to be true?
I think what's happened is that they've adopted a belief system, as we all do, and once you've got that belief system in your head, it's sort of unfalsifiable. Everything becomes interpreted with that particular system. They think they're very special because they've had a weird experience. They often don't understand how their brain and body work, so, you know, they've decided that it's genuine. And once you've made that leap of faith, I think it's very hard to go back. It's very difficult to think what evidence would convince you this stuff isn't true. Mm-hmm. So I think they're sort of trapped in a kind of belief system.
And in your experience, how difficult is it to bring them out of that sort of cycle?
Almost impossible. Mm-hmm. I when I wrote Paranormality, I was thinking, you know, that if you imagine a bell curve where you've got the extreme believers down one end, you're never going to reach them. You know, there's no point in writing a book for them. They're just going to loathe it. You have your skeptics at the other end where they're already convinced. But to me, the real audience is those large number of people in the middle that haven't made up their minds one way or the other. I think that those are an audience that are worth sort of playing to.
And what's a good strategy for reaching those people? I've always believed that one of the best ways is to get them while they're young. Another method is sort of like the Mythbuster style of entertaining them while you're educating them. What style do you like best?
I think both of those are helpful. I think understanding why people form these beliefs, what they get out of them, is helpful. To me, if they see skeptics having fun and being open-minded. I mean, if they look at a group of people and go, look, you've made up your mind that it's not true. You're just as bad as the believers, but in the opposite direction. They won't want to affiliate with that group. So I think what we say is, look, we are open-minded. We want the evidence to be there to convince us. Otherwise, we're not going to be convinced. That's a very reasonable, defendable position. And as soon as you go, the more extreme version of that, of none of it's true, it can't be true, we know it's not true, and all of that, I think you'll be turning those people off.
Right. And you've developed a lot of new experiments developing things like Twitter and social media involving public participation. What's been the results from these experiments with Twitter and such?
Well, there's two sets of activities there. One is engaging people with science and skepticism via Twitter and the blog and so on. I enjoy that. It's a real game changer for me because as a psychologist, I can get 1,000 people to do an online experiment in about 20 minutes now. So it's just wonderful. In terms of the ESP work, which we did with Twitter and done with other social media, we've seen exactly the same findings that we've got in the lab, which is that ESP seems rather evasive, to say the least.
And of these sort of the new experiments, which ones do you like the best that really sort of inspire you for the new generation of skeptics out there?
Well, I think all of our work, I mean, unless I'm passionate about an experiment, I don't do it. The Twitter remote viewing, because that was the first one we did, where we went to a location and then said to everyone on Twitter, you know, just send in ideas of where we are, and then we gave them four possible locations and had to choose it. Because it was all done in real time, it just feels kind of weird but kind of cool to send out a tweet and have thousands of people taking part in your study in a way that was literally impossible, as I say, 5 years ago. So I think scientists, psychologists are just starting to get their head around what social media actually mean for them.
And you mentioned that your background is magic, and a lot of skeptics, James Randi, Penn and Teller, have magical backgrounds. So what about magic makes people be skeptical?
Well, I think there's a few things going on. One is that unless you're of a skeptical, inquiring mindset, you don't tend to be into magic. I mean, it's about puzzles and solving puzzles. But the other is that as a magician, your experience is of constantly performing, quote, miracles. And then people going, I can't work that out. And you yourself know the secret is very straightforward. But then they tell you what you've just done, and it bears no resemblance to what you just did. You're used to eyewitness testimony being rather inaccurate. And then you think, well, if it's inaccurate there, what about ghosts? What about mediums? What about psychics? And so I think it just naturally makes you rather skeptical.
And what are your thoughts on studying magic from a scientific point of view, trying to learn the psychological effects that magic has on people, things like change of blindness and such?
I think it's a very mixed message that's coming out of all that work. So, yes, there are some things magicians do that psychologists don't understand, and psychologists will probably learn from that. But if you take change blindness, I can't really think how magicians use that. It's a perceptual quirk. I've made films about it, but it doesn't really inform my understanding of magic. So I think we need some clear thinking in this area. Mm-hmm. Yes, there are little bits that magicians do that psychologists could learn from, but I suspect magicians will not get very much out of it in that sense.
From the science point of view, do you think there's untapped potential to look deeply into the magical training?
Not deeply, because I think it's like optical illusions. I think each optical illusion works for very different reasons. There's not really a theory of optical illusions. There's after images, and there's size constancy, and so on. And it's going to be the same with magic tricks. They work for different reasons. There will never be an overarching theory of magic. Mm-hmm. There'll be some tricks that work because the magicians manipulate attention. Other times because you think you've made a free choice and you haven't. So I don't think there's going to be this overarching theory, but there may be little nuggets in there which is of interest to very specialized areas in psychology.
Okay. Well, Richard, thank you for joining us on Radio Free Thinker. Enjoy TAM. And please visit us in Vancouver at some point.
That would be very lovely. It's a lovely place to be, actually, Vancouver. I've been there once in my life. So thank you. I'm looking forward to TAM.
Well-known pimp. Narcotics king. Big-time racketeer. Back in full force.
This could be one of the big moments in your life. Don't make it your last.
Look, this thing might be bigger than even we think it is.
Do you need an upgrade to the soundtrack to your life? Perhaps a song from a film or a tune from TV? My name is Gap. Exploding Head Movies is here to give you sounds from the cinema, along with the songs that will be defining your future, and those forgotten classics that need a little rescue.
Come on, baby. Come on. I won't let you down.
Loading Head Movies, Monday, 7:30 to 9 p.m. on CITR 101.9 FM, Vancouver.
And we're back on Radio Free Thinker. Our thanks to Richard Wiseman for the interview. I encourage you to stay tuned for more TAM interviews in the coming weeks. Let's go into our skeptical highlights. Don?
Yes. Well, as some people in the Vancouver area may or may not know, Pride Week is coming up. And the BC Humanists are going to be in the Pride Parade. On Sunday, July 31st, the BC Humanists will be marching in the Vancouver Pride Parade for a second consecutive year to show their support for the LGBTQ community and to promote humanism in the wider community. Anyone who wants to participate in this march should show up at Section F by 12:30. The parade takes 2 hours to walk, so bring lots of water, sunscreen, and a flamboyant outfit. Anyone wanting to know what section F is, it's too long for me to say on the show, so just check out our notes on our podcast.
Excellent.
Don, could you give us an example of what a flamboyant outfit might be?
Something with feathers, preferably colorful feathers. Anyone who's seen the movie Rio, I might suggest that. Of course, my own personal favorite is more of the short sort of thing. You know, lots of skin, that's always quite nice. Glitter, lots of glitter, very good to have.
Excellent. Well, my skeptical highlight is Vancouver Skepticamp 2011. This is our fifth Skepticamp. It's taking place August 6th, which is a Saturday, 10 a.m. to 7 p.m. in the Victoria Learning Theater over at Irving K. Berber Learning Center here at UBC, room 182. Vancouver Skepticamp is a fun, informal, one-day, free, open, attendee-driven, grassroots skeptical conference featuring brief 10-minute presentations with Q&A sessions afterwards. And our hope is to make this year's event as successful as the previous Vancouver Skepticamps, but we need your help. So, if you want to participate, if you want to come by, you can register for free, and you can do that at vancouver.skepticamp.org, and you can decide if you want a t-shirt or if you want to meet after Skepticamp for a skeptical-themed dinner someplace. As we said, this is our fifth Skepticamp. We have a roster of 18 speakers, but even if our speaker roster is full, please come out and participate. We do encourage everyone to ask questions and to have lively debates about the themes that we're discussing. So, come on out, August 6th, 10 a.m. Gonna be fun.
Ethan, can you give us maybe a teaser or two about what might be said and who might be saying it?
Well, it's going to be a very diverse group. We've taken great effort to make sure that we have a number of women presenting this year. Last year, we only had one, which wasn't enough. So we have a lot of different talks, everything from philosophy to humanism to skepticism to atheism and the entire range of the free thought movement will be represented, and I'm sure it's going to be very fascinating.
So that sounds quite interesting, and I encourage everyone to show up. But I am left with another perhaps ending thought question for this particular topic. Mm-hmm. You said a skeptical dinner. So are you doubting whether or not you will be eating, or whether or not the term dinner is appropriate and maybe supper is more appropriate, and there's some sort of agnosticism going on here with regards to a skeptical dinner? What's that?
All right, Don, you've now had your rant.
Yeah. Yeah, that's enough of you. So, this is the end of the show. Reminder, subscribe to our podcast on iTunes or visit our website at www.radioreverythinker.com to see our blog and show notes. And if you have any questions, comments, or criticisms, email us at info@radioreverythinker.com. My name is Ethan, your free-thinking historian. Thanks for listening.
And this is Don saying eyes open, minds on.
This is Jenna reminding you that the real world is amazing.
So long, folks.
Bye.
Become a friend of CITR and receive great discounts at businesses.